Hello and welcome to Newspeak, our weekly look at what's happening in the news. I'm joined, as ever, by Rafe Hadelman-Ku, our senior fellow and royal historian, and Amy Gallagher, who is the SDP mayoral candidate for London, and indeed the lady behind Stand Up To Woke, as you know by now. We've been having lots of local events recently. In the past week, we've had four actually, in London, in Salisbury, and in Brighton, and most recently in Nottingham. Very, very exciting. Just wanted to tell you about one coming up, and that's next week, on Tuesday, the 19th of March, in Southampton. It's in the evening, it's entirely free. Do come along because people really do seem to enjoy themselves. It'd be really great to meet you. So if you're in Southampton or roundabout, do come along Tuesday, the 19th of March. To find out details of where, then please just do write to locals at newcultureforum.org.uk. I hope to see you then. I'm going to start actually with a very uncharacteristic thing for this show, and that's good news. This is about basically puberty blockers. As you might have seen, Amy, they have been outlawed, have they not?
Yeah, they've been banned by the NHS. I mean, this has come after about 20 years of people speaking up. Some of the Tavistock whistleblowers were speaking up as early as 2005. And it's taken a hell of a lot for us to get here, and a lot of people having to unfortunately lose their careers, and a lot of people being shut down. The evidence was never there that these should have been used. Patients were being told that they were reversible. They're not reversible. The side effects were never being given any consideration, and there was never a proper evidence base for these. And obviously, you know, I'll see it in my documentary, but it really was the case of Keira Bell, a patient who sued the Tavistock. She was someone who went on puberty blockers, went on to have a breast removed, and then regretted it, then brought a lawsuit against them that really got the attention of what was happening at the Tavistock. And then obviously that led to the CAS review. And now finally we have had this confirmation from NHS that going forward, as of 1st of April of this year, nobody will be prescribed puberty blockers, and gender clinics will not have a medicalised pathway, which is great. It's fantastic news.
So great news. Mm. And first of all, before then, what were the side effects actually?
Oh gosh, I mean, lots of things. I mean, osteoporosis has an effect on bone density, has an effect on sexual function. Patients reporting all different types of side effects. And now there's now, only recently we've seen that there is now links to cancer as well, coming, we've seen in the WPF scandal. And you know, effects on mood, effects on mental health, all sorts of things. Keira Bell herself has now had her voice affected. She now gets facial hair, which is remaining despite the fact that she stopped taking these medicines. So obviously we don't fully know the effects long term. You know,
can I ask actually, why this, for me anyway, it's slightly come out of the blue. You mentioned your documentary there, and you go into it. That's the Heresies documentary that Amy's made, doing very well. But why do you think, what has brought this about now?
Well, the CAS review, the interim findings of the CAS review and the recommendations from Dr. Hilary Cass, the paediatrician that led this review, came out about June last year, and she was recommending quite strongly that puberty blockers shouldn't be routinely used, and they should only be used in exceptional circumstances. I think what's happened is that the NHS is preparing for these new gender clinics, yes, essentially, and they've been preparing their guidelines for that. It's actually gone a bit further than we expected, because these new guidelines say that puberty blockers should never be used, not even in exceptional circumstances. So it's even a bit stronger than the recommendations from last year.
Right.
But I think it's just in preparation for the new gender clinics. I think they're revising their guidelines, and that's why NHS have made this official.
The gender clinics being?
Well, the gender clinics, I mean, they're moving. It was just the Tavistock Gender Identity Service, but now they're having regional clinics that are setting up in order to treat young people with issues around gender. But there will not be a medicalised pathway now. It will just be therapy.
Rafe, it seems to me that when I see this, like about the puberty blockers, it's like a big brick being taken out of the wall of a kind of general ideology. Is that how you sort of see it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's terrific news because it must always be the case with treatment, but particularly, especially one that this serious, that it's evidence, not ideology, that determines the course of action that is taken. And this is a huge step forward in actually reaffirming the evidence here and suppressing the ideology. It, you know, as Amy was saying, the consequences of this, in addition to everything that Amy said also, there's a very real possibility of the brain not maturing as properly because of these puberty blockers, because the brain is fundamentally important in puberty, not just the body, and that there could be a potential rewiring of neural circuits in the brain. So I mean, on all levels, that this is extremely important, and you know, it has to be celebrated. But of course, this is not an outright victory because this is NHS England. NHS Scotland still hasn't come to a decision on this, and we know, of course, that they are probably the wokest part of the continent. And of course, it also doesn't apply to private doctors. And there's an organization called Gender GP, which has said that it will still be able to prescribe puberty blockers and age will not be a factor in its decision for this. And there are actually already crowdfunding schemes for people who want to actually raise money so that people can actually have this done on the private service. So we're a huge step forward, but the battle certainly isn't over.
Yes, it does sort of put down a real marker, doesn't it? If the NHS have banned them, how does it make us stand now internationally?
Yeah, well, very strongly. I mean, because these are still readily available in America and Canada, and they are really looking to us and saying, look, the UK have banned them, and the NHS is such a big name. So we saw, you know, on Twitter, Elon Musk, Jordan Peterson coming out and saying, look, you know, why can't we ban it? The UK is banning it. I mean, I think this issue is much more difficult for the US and Canada to deal with because their health services and their laws are so different from ours. But we are very much leading the way on the fight against transgender ideology in terms of kind of grassroots organisations, but in law and in the NHS.
So in Canada, health is on a provincial basis, but the province of Alberta, which is more or less like Texas in America, they have already banned puberty blockers, leading to huge condemnation from other provinces and also, as you'd expect, from Justin Trudeau. But their conservative leader has also expressed very great concerns about puberty blockers. So this is definitely going to be a precedent that's going to incentivise people around the Anglosphere, at least in this.
It's interesting that, because we're known as Turf Island, aren't we, in terms of ideology. But, you know, when you're, from our point of view, when you're here, you tend to think, my goodness, this is so terrible, we're living in appalling times. I mean, a lot of people have been saying on social media, we might look back and think, how the hell was this ever allowed?
It's one of the biggest medical scandals of our time. Yeah. And as I say in a documentary, it's primarily autistic children and gay children and very vulnerable, traumatised children that have been affected by this. It's absolutely awful, and we've overridden evidence with ideology, and you know, just the idea of puberty blockers. Essentially, you're giving medicine to a perfectly healthy body to interfere with a perfectly healthy process. It's crazy, and it'd be interesting to see how we look back on this. But it is, I mean, we've lived through it, haven't we? And so many people have lost their jobs and stood up against it. It's difficult to know how we'll look back on it and think of this matter.
I'm not a doctor. I don't know at what age puberty stops, but it's under 18s are going to be banned from using these puberty blockers, as I understand. Personally, I've always thought 21 should be the age at which life-changing decisions are made, because 18 still is a young age when people have questions about themselves. People are often still living at home and so forth. Girls going through a tomboy phase, maybe, you know, gay people not sure about their sexuality and all the rest of it. So 21 is actually, I still think we need a target of 21 for people to make such an important decision that affects their health.
What do you think, actually, just being a bit speculative for a moment, in terms of the gender critical ideology? I hate that term even, actually, gender critical. But anyway, people who are against the trans ideology, what would be the next really big victory, do you think, after this? I mean, it needn't be something medical. It could be something in law. Mm. I mean, perhaps something such as defining a woman by law, for example.
Yeah, squashing the Gender Recognition Act. I mean, I think stopping it private, being these beauty bloggers being accessed privately, I think it needs to be seen as a safeguarding issue if parents or doctors are doing that, because they're going against the guidance of NHS England. So I think that could be tightened up. I think another important thing is just the way the media reports trans issues. We've seen even recently men who are murderers or rapists being called she in the media. That still seems to be very much the thing. And nobody, you don't see any media outlets pushing back against that. So I think that will be, if we start to see a shift in the media saying a man who says he is a woman, yes, rather than saying a woman or a trans woman, I think that would be seen as a victory by gender critical feminists.
It doesn't actually take much, does it? They can just simply say something like X or whatever, you know, who identifies as a woman. I mean, even that would be better than copywriters and sub-editors actually coming saying she showed them her penis, which is what we've had actually.
Well, it's not just the media, even in courts you have the terrible situation where, you know, women have been raped, have had to address their rapist as a she or whatever. But, you know, I don't hold out much faith for the media to change their tune in the next few years. We have a Labour government coming in. I don't expect much legislation or anything coming into play to help support any of this. I think, ironically, it is the courts which will be the last repository of any hope for sanity to be restored.
Yes, actually, there's one point on this, is that this hate speech legislation, which is still going through in Ireland, one of the reasons, most of the highlight has been on the fact that it's about having hateful material in your possession or whatever. But also it has all these protected characteristics in it, including gender. I mean, you know, this is, I think, quite new. We don't even have that in this country. It delineates all these various different genders.
You know. Well, another thing that may need to happen, I mean, it's a long way off, I don't think any government will get round to it, but revising the Equalities Act, because it makes these issues so difficult, because you have the protected characteristic of sex-based rights, women's rights, and gender reassignment surgery, and they just conflict. I don't think gender reassignment surgery should ever been in the Equalities Act, and I think the Equalities Act just needs to be revised just generally. But I mean, that's very scary, the idea of gender being a protected characteristic, because when you speak to these people and you ask them what they mean by gender, they often just say it's an essence, or it's just a feeling, or it's, so it can be anything. So you could claim that anything is a protected characteristic, essentially.
It's utterly ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, media, you know, you say the media there have a big part to play. Right, brings us on to our next story, really, because there was this case of the Syrian refugee who, it was in the news recently, he's just been imprisoned, I think, for it's about 18 years or something. But he was, back in 2016, the subject of a BBC Newsnight film. Can you tell us a bit about this? Because frankly, there are all sorts of aspects to this, and he's just been imprisoned for a shocking series of or multiple rape and abuse and whatever of girls. And yet, you would have thought, looking at this film from 2016, he was a bit of a saint.
Yes, no, I mean, I don't think that there aren't many things which better encapsulate the divide between the metropolitan elite and the rest of the country, and the condescending derision that middle classes have for the working classes in this country. And it goes hand in step with the whole Rochdale and, you know, Oldham and the rape gang cases we're all too familiar with. What happened here was there was a family of Syrian refugees called the Bedridden family, who were the subjects of a documentary by BBC's Newsnight, produced presented by Katie Razzle, essentially trying to do this family have come from a hellish background, trying to make a life here, and they're facing hardships in this country. And during the course of this documentary, the 18-year-old son was charged with having raped an underage girl, and there were two other men allegedly involved in this, one also accused with molesting another girl. The BBC, rather than pulling out of the documentary, decided to go forward with this. Because of issues with translation and so forth, the case ended up being thrown out of court, but it didn't stop them from actually taking sides with the Syrian refugees over these underage girls. Because the mother of the Syrian refugees said, it's not in our culture to do such things, so it's impossible for this to have happened. Whereas, of course, we know that's not necessarily the case at all. And yet the BBC went gleefully and blindly along with this. And also, you know, there were accusations perhaps that the girl had been dishonest about something else in the past, and based upon that dishonesty, of course, made a value judgment about her testimony in this case. And then outrageously, with this young boy's testimony too, it came out the allegation that he and these other two were less sexually experienced. Yes. These adults were less sexually experienced, yes, than these underage girls. And it really goes to show exactly what we saw with the covering up of the gang rapes, by suggesting that these young girls somehow deserved it. They were that type of girl. And we've got exactly the same thing here being put out by the BBC on Newsnight. It's flagship news program, which has a reputation for veracity of evidence. And they still bought into all of this. And it particularly grates now when we had, you know, that Me Too movement where women will automatically believe whatever they said, which also has problems, you know, just believing a woman when she makes an allegation. Yeah. But it seems as if when it's a working class girl, actually, that doesn't apply.
Well, also, didn't he try to sort of smear her by saying she was obviously a racist because she actually, she obviously didn't want foreigners like me here or something?
We're talking about somebody who's 12 or 13 years old. You know, the idea that they're going to have these firmly formed, forged racist views, I think, is for the birds.
I think the thing is with this is that, look, you know, you've got to kind of be fair, all the rest of it. BBC were just reporting as they said, because they have spoken about it since. They said, we were reporting the facts as they were at the time. It's not really the point, is it? That's quite right. There were the facts. He was acquitted for these reasons and everything. He went on then to do these appalling things, made these girls' lives a living hell, actually. Tried to get them to convert to Islam, you know, appalling abuse as well, rape.
Yeah.
And yet, doesn't it show something about the general attitude, as Rafe says, of the BBC?
Yeah, I think, you know, as you say, the allegations weren't founded at the time, but I think it's just the naivety or even the stupidity of the BBC to just do a documentary like this. I mean, this is part of a broader theme, and we spoke about it on the show before. There was a BBC editor who gave evidence in court to stop a Somalian refugee being deported, and then he went on to commit a gang rape. And there was also a Channel 4 documentary called The Jihadis Next Door, which featured someone who would go on to be the ringleader of the London Bridge bombing attack, terrorist attacks. There is something about liberal media which seem to see these particular groups as, well, firstly just interesting, they want to support them, and they want to shine a light on their stories with such naivety, and it's almost to the point of, it feels like a pathological kind of self-destruction, that they don't want to see the other side of what these people are capable of. I think it does come back to this idea, the sort of left idea of, you know, you can take someone out of a particular culture and then their inherent goodness will just come out, you know, like a Rousseauian idea of a man is born free, but everywhere is in chains, that you can just take someone out of a war-torn country or a really strongly patriarchal Islamic country and just expose them to the BBC, and suddenly they'll be wonderful and tolerant like all of us. Mm. And it's just not true. And they don't want to seem to think about, you know, that these people's culture and their temperament and everything is so different from ours, that they don't want to see the risk. They're so blind to the risk that these people pose.
I mean, I go a bit further than you saying, you know, you say about naivety. I think, yes, in some cases naivety, but I think a lot of it is actual downright self-hatred or hatred of your own culture. I mean, particularly with the working class part of it, which is what you said at the beginning, isn't it?
Exactly. It's self-loathing. It's reinforcing these stereotypes they have about the working class and being racist and being promiscuous and all this sort of thing. But again, this is all about ideology, as it was with puberty blockers. This is about people being blind to the truth, blinded by their ideology. It's a sort of cult-like mentality. You know, it sort of reminds me of people in the Soviet Union who simply wouldn't believe in the gulags. And, you know, you probably could take them to the gulags and they would just deny that they existed. Mm. And it's that sort of thing. And we have to think about this woke mind virus as a sort of a cult-like behavior, where people have suddenly, you know, vast sway, our entire, you don't think of the establishment as being susceptible to that, to a cult-like sort of ideology, but they are actually impervious to the truth now.
Yeah. I think impervious, I think also just, you know, far more sheep-like. I think that, you know, if you want real sheep-likeness in thinking and fashion, that's where you look. It's not to ordinary people. What should the BBC actually ideally do, do you think?
Well, I think Katie Razzle, who presented this and who wrote an article about it as well, needs to come out and make a statement about this whole thing, because, yes, it's true, the BBC did present the factual case and this chap was not convicted of anything in relation to this first issue, but it is undeniable the slant of the documentary and the everything we just implied. That, I think, merits an apology of some sort.
Finally, I wanted to talk a little bit this week about Lee Anderson going to the Reform Party. This is quite a coup for him. Just a couple of things. What he said, we'll come to that in a minute, but just purely on a kind of practical political level, this is quite something for them, don't you think? Do you think it's going to make a difference to Reform?
Well, it's their first MP, which is quite...
It's actually an MP, isn't it?
Yeah, which is quite significant. I mean, we've seen... Generally, it seems to be the way of the smaller parties now, that the way they get an MP is through somebody defecting. We saw that with Lawrence Fox's Reclaim and Andrew Bridgen. But yeah, it is significant that they've got an MP. And I think it's... I think Lee Anderson's whole kind of political journey, obviously he was initially a Labour councillor and then went to Tory, went Conservative and is now with Reform. I think it very much reflects the kind of journey of Northern white working class, in that they were let down by Labour. They've now, you know, let down by the Conservatives' promise to revitalise the North. And now they're probably politically homeless and looking to the smaller parties.
Yes, I think it's an interesting one actually as well, because I remember when Douglas Carswell came over to UKIP, he was known to people in politics, but not really outside, not really. And this is a great strength, it seems to me, of Lee
Anderson. Yeah, I think it's a great coup. Remember, this is the former deputy chairman of the Conservative Party.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think his departure to Reform opens the pathway for other Tory MPs. I mean, I think there are 60 MPs have now already said they're not going to stand for re-election because, of course, they know they're going to be defeated if they did stand. And the popularity of the Tory Party took a great tumble of about 5 points when they fired Suella Braverman and hired David Cameron, and the whole strategy there was clear. Sunak was jettisoning the red wall. He was setting it adrift in order to focus on securing the blue wall, who have very different values. And I think this is following in the wake of that. This is the second stage. I don't think it's going to create a 5% rise in the polls for the Reform Party, but it could easily do 1 or 2. And that's all going to just narrow the gap between the Tories and Reform Party to critical levels for the Tory Party. And there's actually a sort of a parallel here, because there was another Reform Party in the 90s in Canada. And the north-south divide here is very similar to the west-east divide in Canada, the west and the north both feeling disconnected from the centre of power, and also much more socially conservative. The west is sort of cowboys and Christians. And what happened there was, in 1993, the Reform Party split the Tory vote, making the Tories go down to just 2 MPs left. And the Reform Party became the bigger party. And the Progressive Conservative Party, the great historic party, ended up dying. And the Reform Party became a new Conservative Party, allying with it. And that was a huge seismic shift. And so the similarities there, the potential there, either at this election or the next one, are for a complete seismic tectonic plate change to actually create a real Conservative Party in Canada, rather than this China Conservative and name only party we have now. And then if I were Richard Tice, I would be looking to that, and I would be getting advice from the Canadians who went through precisely the same thing in the 90s.
Is that with first past the post?
Yeah.
Really? See, that gives one real hope, doesn't it, actually?
Yeah, and apparently there are lots of Tory MPs who behind closed doors are thinking about defecting to Reform. I mean, obviously some of them will lose their seats, as Rafe said, in the election. But I think, you know, people have becoming for a long time been very dissatisfied with the Conservative Party and really do not see it as a party for Conservative values. Reform is now, you know, presenting itself as much more of a Conservative Party than the main one. And I think, you know, Lee Anderson was the final link, I think, to the Red Wall. They've now severed that link. So I think, you know, there's a huge potential now for Reform or the other smaller parties to, you know, galvanise the the North and all the people that have been let down by the Conservative Party and gain their votes. And it's very, I mean, I don't know what the Conservative Party are thinking, but they seem to want to go back to some kind of Blairite, David Cameron version of the party, you know, getting rid of Suella and Lee Anderson. And now there's ideas that people are gonna, there's no confidence votes coming in for Rishi. So this is really, it is, you know, the Conservative Party is, you know, not the place to be.
Well, and of course we know that after the next election, the Tory MPs who are expected to keep their seats are going to be on the left of the Tory party. You know, the Gillian Keegans and the and all these sorts of characters. Now, I'm not saying that, I don't think the Reform Party has anywhere near the polling strength now to actually cause this, what the Canadian situation to happen at this election. But certainly the question is whether Lee Anderson would actually help pave the way for Tories in the Red Wall, because the Tories in the Red Wall know what's going on. And there are places like Hartlepool, and Barnsley, you know, Ashfield, where Lee Anderson is, where the Brexit Party was very good in 2019, you could actually have a pale blue wall, pale blue being the Reform Party's colours, going there. So Labour shouldn't, because those people don't really have any desire to vote Labour, I would have thought, given that on Islam, on immigration, on woke issues, you know, the Labour is not offering a safe home for them. So there is potential there. The question is Lee Anderson a big of enough character to draw that vote in, or does it still require Nigel Farage to come on side? And it's also interesting, of course, you know, it was only a few months ago that Lee Anderson was attacking Richard Tice, calling him a pound shop Farage. And then to which, you know, Tice said, well, you know, I might be a pound, but you're 30p Lee, right? So they still have something to sort out themselves, but there's great potential there.
I think the thing is that when people come back and say, oh, only a while ago you were saying that only, but then politics, I think, would stop if everyone was held to their previous statements. I think, interestingly, you know, we're talking about the Red Wall for a minute. It seems to me that none of the people elected in the Red Wall last time have actually really distinguished themselves. That's another thing. There were a few people who sort of, Ben Bradley, I think, being one, who for a while people thought, oh, these kind of bright new, and they've disappeared pretty much.
But I think the question is, have they disappeared themselves, or have they simply not been given the platform by Conservative Central Office? Because we can't just say the visibility of MPs is largely dependent on whether the Conservative Party Central Office puts them forward for things. I think Ben Bradley on you know, the culture wars is very good. Jonathan Gullis, I'm not as keen on, but I still think I'm not sure whether he's a Red Wall MP or not, but he's also very sound on immigration and these sorts of things. I wouldn't be so dismissive of them, but yes, they haven't been as vocal in recent but again, a lot of them just feel so disheartened by their party.
I think he acquitted himself at that press conference when he, you know, said, I'm joining Reform, very well. I just want to just ask you one thing as well, because of course, before we say anything, isn't it brilliant that he didn't ever apologise for the Sadiq Khan comments? Even if he said my language was clumsy or something, but people roughly know what he's talking about. This is the point, right? And he's stuck to his guns and not done that. I think that in this climate, that is very, very good. He said, I want my country back, right? You know, obviously, that immediately the usual suspects are going to jump on that. And they're going to say, what do you mean? Too many immigrants and all the rest. Well, he might well mean that, actually. Why not? But at the same time, it's not quite, when someone says, I want my country back, what would you say people really mean by that?
I mean, people said that a lot in relation to Brexit, didn't they? And they meant in relation to the European core, you know. So it could mean lots of different things. I mean, how I interpret it from Lee Anderson is just a feeling that we are losing our culture and our identity, and we are, our country's, you know, not what it was. I mean, you can think of that in all different ways, but I wouldn't necessarily, I mean, and mass immigration is a part of that, but I think, you know, court saying that it's racist or xenophobic to say something like that, I think that's a very large jump. I don't think it is at all.
What do you say, Ryan?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, the old expression, the past is a foreign country. I'd say Britain now is a foreign country. I mean, everything about this country just seems unrecognisable to the way, and I'm not just talking about the demographic change in the northern mill town cities and in London and so forth. I'm just talking about every single aspect of our national life seems to be completely different to how it was just 20 years ago. And so when you say, I want my country back, you know, I just want common sense to prevail once again, and I want majority opinions to actually rule the day.
I think that's the crucial part for me anyway, that end, and that is the sense that those in charge do not have our best interests at heart and are not even acting out of a kind of sense of Britain or love of Britain. So I think that that's what people, and also actually you see it, don't you see it really in very specific ways, like the police. You know, if they are on the front line of enforcing our laws, they no longer feel like our police. That's because I don't think they are, right? But the fact is that that is what people really mean. But over and above that, there is this demographic change. I think there's no question about it, isn't there? You know, that if you can no longer even sense who your neighbour is. You know?
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a very powerful line. It's still being used, isn't it? It was used by Trump as well, wasn't it, in America? I mean, good luck to them, I think. I mean, you know, they are the only game in town reform now, aren't they? You know, and let's see what happens. But sorry, because I know you're in the SDP. What am I? Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
I'm politically homeless at the moment. So, you know, I think you'd be very tolerant.
I know what you mean. That's okay.
Anyway, thank you very much, Amy. Thanks so much, Ray. And we will see you next week. But as I said, remember, if you want to come to Southampton next Tuesday, the 19th of March, do get in touch. locals@newcultureforum.org.uk. Take care, bye. Hello. If you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.